Coming up today, CIA hacks shrinking Wallys, and we catch up with the man speeding up science for Mark Zuckerberg. You're listening to episode 308 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Matt Burgess.
Hello.
Sorry, Matt doesn't have a microphone to himself, so he just lunged
dives
at the microphone.
Across the room.
Vicky Wollaston.
Hello.
And Greg Williams.
Hello. I was a bit actually terrified when Matt came towards me.
So, Greg, yesterday was Wired Health.
Yes.
It was a great day. We're all
such
a little
a
bit sleepy
day.
Today because it's a very long day.
Yeah, very long day, but a terrific day. And I think that really it was just one of the most inspiring events that we've done. Had so many amazing speakers. We had, you know, computational biologists, cardiologists, behavioral scientists, microbiologists, public health practitioners, physicians, technologists, therapists, neuroscientists, geneticists, patients, advocates.
If your job ends in ists, then chances are you were there.
Exactly.
What really struck me about it, and this is always the case with Wired Health, is that they're incredibly, incredibly intelligent and driven people, but a lot of them have a very personal reason for why they're driven by it, an illness in the family, a problem that they suffered themselves.
Yeah.
And this really drives them on.
Yeah, I think that was the case with so many of the speakers yesterday. I mean, Daisy Robinson, who's a postdoctoral scientist at Harvard, she was talking about how she was inspired to start stem cell research because her sister had been diagnosed as a diabetic when she was a child, so she'd seen the very real world effects of that on her family. And so many other people that were speaking yesterday, including Matt Eagles, who's had Parkinson's since he was 8 years old and is now a patient advocate, and is talking about how deep brain stimulation has really helped the quality of his life and helped him to, you know, live a full life. And there he was on our stage yesterday, giving an incredibly lucid and great talk.
And he's had the implants in his brain, the electrodes that allowed him to lead this normal life for 10 years.
So yes, that's right.
It's a sign of how far the technology's come since, but also how technology has been changing people's lives for a long time already.
Yeah.
And who knows where it will be in 10 years from now.
Absolutely. I mean, and I think that's the really kind of powerful thing about the event, is that it's all, you know, practical. This is real world stuff that people are doing, either in terms of kind of the research they're doing, which is, you know, incredibly innovative and thoughtful and based on kind of, you know, deep experience in a particular area, or they're people who have for whatever reason had a life experience and decided, actually, I need to change my focus in life, and I need to think about how I'm going to, you know, use my professional skills and my knowledge to really move an area forward.
There's a few people we should thank. Joao, of course, for putting together the event. He's got today off, a well-earned rest.
Joao is off today, and he really does deserve it. I mean, we had 20 world-class speakers there yesterday. You know, we had Jessica Mega from Verily. We had Aldo Faisal from Imperial just down the road. We had Jeremy Freeman from the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, David Halpern from the Behavioral Insights team. A whole bunch of people who really were just incredibly inspiring. And, you know, throughout every year, I always think, well, is he actually going to be able to do something better next year? And he always pulls it out of the bag. So, a great job. So many people that I haven't mentioned, you know, Beth Healy, who's a research director at the European Space Agency, and Elizabeth Parrish, who's a life scientist who's looking at aging. Just so many inspiring, great speakers. I can't really, you know, recommend high enough. People should wait for the video to come out and make sure they see all these talks.
Yep. So if you couldn't be there yesterday, and if you were there, thank you for coming. But if you couldn't, we filmed all the talks. We're editing them together as we speak, and a few of them should be going live on the site next week, so everyone can get a taste of what went on.
Great. I actually can't wait to rewatch a lot of the talks.
Yeah, we can't concentrate for the whole day, so sometimes there's times when we're not in the room, so there's a few I want to catch up on as well. Thanks very much, Greg. Before we go to our first story, I forgot at the top of the show, a thing you learned this week. Matt Burgess, you've been quiet because you haven't had a microphone.
Thank you for finally allowing me to speak. I feel empowered. The thing that I've learned this week is that across London, there are 13 protected lines of sight.
This is good. Most of them involving St. Paul's, right?
Yes, they are. So across the whole city, there are 13 views, I think they are, across vistas of like really historic landmarks and areas that basically you should be able to see from one place to the other. And I think from some places, from Richmond all the way to St. Paul's is about 15 miles. So nothing can be built in those area, in that line of view, or behind St. Paul's in that case, because that would spoil the view as well.
Oh, wow. Actually, from Chiswick tube station platform, you can see the London Eye. And that always, I used to get off the tube and that always surprised me.
I don't think Chiswick Station is one of the protected ones.
But no, but it, what I mean is like, it's amazing how much we have, but how much you can see. If there isn't anything in the way, you can really like see for miles and miles. It's really interesting.
Yeah, and it's why if you look at St. Paul's from a bridge going over the Thames, you can see there's like a dip in the buildings around it. All the high stuff is sort of flung to the wings, because the idea is that St. Paul should be able to be seen from as many places as possible.
And I think actually the walkie-talkie or one of the buildings was built so it had a curve in it, so it wouldn't actually disrupt that view.
Oh, wow.
Which is interesting.
Top facts. Vicky?
My fact is about hippos. So hippos can stand... Bit different.
Yep.
Hippos can stand in the sun all day without getting sunburned, because they actually produce their own form of sunscreen, like suntan lotion. Hmm. And it comes out of their glands as a sticky red sweat. So there you go. That's why they don't ever get sunburned.
Clever hippos.
Yeah.
Elephants the same?
I don't know. I don't think so.
I mean, they're very different animals.
Yeah, only because they're the same colour. Doesn't mean they're the same
Matt
animal.
Burgess, top biologist. I learnt this week, the first ever banner advert, which appeared on an early version of Wired, which was hotwired.com in October 1994, had a click-through rate of 78%. So that means 78% of people that saw that advert clicked on it.
Wow.
Yep. What is it now? The average across the industry for a banner click.
Are you asking us to guess?
Yeah.
Vicky, do you want to go first? Because you're the website editor, so you know this.
I don't know this. Yeah. I would say 40.
40%.
I'm going to say 0.12%.
Oh, God, I went really high then.
Yeah, you went really high. If it was 40%, then I don't think journalism would have the problems that it currently has. It's 0.00 or 0.01%. There's a big range depending on who's quoting the figure.
So some of them could be 40%.
Some of them could be. It could go that high. Yeah. Now, as Greg said a little earlier, one of the people speaking at Wired Health was Jeremy Freeman. He's the second employee at the Chan Zuckerberg Institute's science team, and he's the manager of computational biology. It's not often that you hear from people that work for these kind of organizations. There's a certain degree of secrecy around them and a certain degree of them wanting to kind of get on with the work rather than doing lots of press. But it was very interesting to hear him talk about the work he's been doing in the short time that he's been there, only about 4 months, and what his goals are over the coming years. What I was really surprised by is he's so young, such a young guy, and he's already done quite a lot in his life. So he was previously at a neuroscience research laboratory in Genalia, which is a non-profit based near Washington, D.C., and he was hired by the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative effectively to speed up science. So the CZI is... Priscilla and Mark Zuckerberg's philanthropic arm. They announced the first wave of it a couple of years ago now, I think, maybe 18 months ago, to tackle education. And this was after their daughter was born. And since then, they've extended it to science. It's got about $3 billion behind it. So it's one of the most well-funded philanthropic ventures in the world. And the aim of science is to make science quicker, better, and it has a slightly modest goal of what's the exact line of it? I can't remember off the top of my head.
Isn't it to cure all disease?
It's to cure, manage or treat all diseases by the end of the century. Yeah,
which is fairly ambitious.
It's fairly ambitious.
Pretty punchy.
Yes. Yeah. So Jeremy Freeman was at Wired Health yesterday to talk about his role and what he's going to be doing next. So he explained that there are still only 4 employees at the science arm of the Chan Zuckerberg Institute. Or is it Institute or Initiative?
Initiative.
And interestingly, so it's looking at education and science. It has a central engineering team. So each of the different projects has its own specialisms, but then there's a team of central engineers within the CZI that are responsible with coming up with technologies and solutions to problems. And the idea is that problems that affect education might also affect science. So there'll be similar learnings to be shared and used in different ways. And yeah, so his job is to make science happen faster.
But I mean, that was a bit of a thread yesterday at Wired Health. There was quite a few people saying that we shouldn't just be looking at these problems in silos. So Jasmine Fisher from Microsoft Research, she said that actually you could treat biology like a computer program. If you go through the same processes and you have the sort of same ideas behind it, there's no reason why you can't look at a biological program in the same way you would a computer program. And this is that sort of thing. It's trying to share knowledge, basically.
Yes. Yeah. So what he found when he was working in the neuroscience lab at Genalia was that, and he started tackling it as a neuroscience problem, that they were collecting huge amounts of data and very complicated data that's very difficult for artificial intelligence and machine learning programs to understand, or even humans. Oftentimes it will be like a microscopy video of brain activity, and there's nothing really there for a computer to easily interpret. So you've got this huge, huge quantity of data, but then what do you do with it? So he explained that by his estimate, labs used to spend about 80% of their time running experiments and 20% of the time looking at data. And he said that that has now flipped, and that you have very, very intelligent, qualified researchers spending 80% of their time just handling this big jelly mass of data and only 20% of their time doing experiments. And that needs to change if organizations like the CZI are to reach their goal of curing, managing, and treating all disease by the end of the century.
And it goes back to actually what Daniel Kraft said yesterday at Wired Health, was that only because something can tell you how long you've slept or can tell you how many steps you've done, so what? And that's the idea behind that, isn't it? Is that, well, let's actually use this data and actually see what it's showing us rather than just going, well, we've got loads of it.
Mm. And you've got research laboratories all over the world doing amazing work and making huge breakthroughs. But very often there's not a great deal of collaboration and cooperation. It happens in silos. And while the scientific community is all about cooperation and collaboration, there aren't any set tools where there are, but there isn't sort of an overarching agreement on set tools and standards, so an awful lot of work is repeated. Solutions that one laboratory comes up with might not be known by another in terms of how they handle data. So Freeman said, a lot of biology is really limited and bottlenecked by the ways we process data and disseminate our knowledge. There's a huge opportunity to use software and technology to make science more effective, efficient, and collaborative. And that was sort of his mantra, effective, efficient, and collaborative. So the idea is that the CZI, backed by $3 billion of money that it can not effectively do what it wants with, but that it's kind of got free rein over, can start to tackle some of these problems. So it's aiming to develop tools and ways of handling data that are open source and create standards for capturing, storing, studying, and disseminating data that are easier and faster than what is currently available. So it's delivering the kind of revolution that we've seen in personal computing to academic computing.
I think one of the really interesting things for me about this is actually when Zuckerberg said he was going to give all his fortune away and it sort of he was going to give it to charities and his, and then created this initiative, there's quite a lot of criticism around isn't this going to be just another way for Facebook to collect your data and use it in a medical context? And I think Freeman was saying that's not quite the case.
Yeah, and he said there was an interesting difference between how it's being perceived in Europe and the US. So in the US, there's a greater understanding in history of big philanthropic gestures. You have things like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. People are quite familiar with this idea of billionaires giving up huge portions of their fortune, or even small portions of their fortune, to try and solve some big problems. Whereas in Europe, it's maybe more seen as the role of the state. And so he said that there'd been this different interpretation on either side of the Atlantic. But as far as he's concerned, and as far as the structure of the organization is concerned, they're entirely separate. So even though Mark Zuckerberg is involved in both, they are in a different office, they're different teams, they're not allowed to second people from Facebook and vice versa. It's not about Facebook developing health tools. It's seemingly a good thing. There's nothing that he felt concerned about, as I think an early skeptic of these kind of organizations. So workshops have already been held to identify areas where technology could have an impact on how the scientific community handles data. And one thing that was really interesting about the presentation that he gave was he was talking about the way that scientists share their results once they have them. And we spend a lot of time looking at this sort of stuff at Wired. It's an academic paper. It's a PDF on a journal that you can download, and you can look at charts and graphs and read a static document. That's what it is, basically. There might be the odd chance to download a bit of data or watch a video or look at some pictures, but for the most part, it's the same technology that's been around for hundreds of years, albeit you can now download it in a PDF. And to Freeman's mind, and this is a fair point, that's ridiculous. When you've got tools for analyzing data for sort of consumer side stuff that is so advanced and allows you to really interact with it and share it and do interesting things with it. So one of their big early goals is to fix that, is to stop
kill the PDF.
Yeah, and it is kind of to an extent where science goes not to die, but there's so much life in scientific research and it isn't reflected in a static PDF document. So that's one of their big early challenges. It was really interesting to hear him talk. And to Matt's point about their relationship with Facebook, and this speaks to Freeman's background and might be potentially why the CZI was so interested in hiring them. A lot of his early research, and he's still very young, was in making neuroscience research open and data handling more open source. The word open just keeps on coming up over and over again. So Freeman said, my instinct is there won't just be one system for handling and processing data in science. I personally favor a loosely federated open source system. The key thing is bringing the principles of quality software engineering to science. And there you can kind of understand the link to Facebook. It's hiring lots of very good engineers who are very good at these kind of problems to help scientists who are very good at the science. His full talk, as I said a little earlier, along with all the rest of the Wired Health talks, will be up on wired.co.uk over the coming weeks, and the article that we wrote about Jeremy Freeman will be going live a little later today, I believe. Okay, our second story, a bit of a change of direction. Matt Burgess, this week the CIA was in the news, and as was WikiLeaks once again.
Yeah, WikiLeaks is back. Well, I guess it never really went away, but it's back in a very, very big way this week with a disclosure of 8,761 documents from the CIA's own internal files, and basically saying what they can hack and what their capabilities for hacking and their research around accessing information on devices are.
So it's the CIA's hacking toolkit, effectively.
That's what it is. And WikiLeaks has released these in what it's calling part one of the Vault 7 files. I don't actually know why they're called Vault 7 files, but I think it's a catchy name, I guess. But these are documents, most of them are marked as secret, top secret, and there's a few in there that aren't quite as interesting, but they basically disclose a lot of iOS and Android vulnerabilities. So these are security problems on devices that could, if used by people, potentially the CIA or anybody else that has them, access information from your device, control your device, but it depends on what the actual sort of vulnerability is from.
So give us an idea of what they've what they're capable of.
So as with all of these sort of things, they have catchy names. So there's Elder Piggy, Juggernaut, and Winter Spy. And I think that Winter Spy was one of the actual quite interesting ones, but another one as well was Weeping Angel, and this didn't actually focus on TVs. It did focus on TVs. It didn't focus on phones, and this was a vulnerability or a developed vulnerability in the Samsung F8000 smart TV, and this basically allows somebody who has access to a TV to make it appear as though it's turned off, make it appear that it's in a fake off mode, the picture goes black, there's nothing on the screen, but actually it's listening to you and then transmitting information about what you're saying or recording it.
Right, and this has always been the slight danger, the hidden danger of smart TVs, that they're great because they can listen to you. You can say, rewind that or switch to channel 4 and it will be able to do it. And the idea is that it doesn't listen to you all the time, it just listens to trigger words. But if you can get to it and get out a vulnerability in it, then, as you say, you can set it to this fake off mode. What else was there?
So, as well as the TV stuff for iOS and Android, there was actually some suggestion that messaging apps are insecure. So, in particular, WikiLeaks was saying that WhatsApp and Signal, which both implement end-to-end encryption, meaning nobody can actually, no third party like Facebook, which owns WhatsApp, can access messages on your device. They actually suggested that these were insecure, but I think that this was one of the things that was wrong in some of these documents, or at least the analytics of these documents in saying that actually these apps aren't secure. Their encryption is completely secure still, but if somebody hacks your device, then they can access the information on there.
So the reporting around this was misleading, and there was a couple of people on Twitter that summarized it quite well. So as you say, if your device is hacked, people can read stuff that's stored on your device because it's the same as them having the phone in their hand. It could be
that anywhere. Goes for any app.
So it's the same as saying that I can hack your WhatsApp by standing behind you while you're sending a message because I can see your phone.
That is exactly
you
it.
Cannot hack end-to-end encryption.
By its very nature, you're not meant to be able to.
And it's worth repeating that Signal and WhatsApp are still very secure for sending messages as long as your phone hasn't already been hacked.
Yes, unless the CIA has the keys that enable them to decrypt the messages, then end-to-end encryption remains solid. So that was a bit of an error in the reporting. And I'm not sure if it was something that was led by WikiLeaks's sort of interpretation of what it put out, or if it was the way that journalists interpreted it, but it's wrong.
So some of the reports were going after, like, look how crazy it is that CIA is doing this, which is fair. But a lot of the reports were then criticising Apple and Google, or the likes of those, and Samsung for letting these things happen. So, I mean, have they fixed them?
I think that, yes, in a lot of cases, Apple and Google were, and Samsung and all the other companies affected in this, were actually surprised by the disclosures. They weren't expecting it. WikiLeaks hadn't given them the information about this to begin with, but they said in future disclosures, because this is only part one, they are going to actually give them the information about the problems that are contained in these CIA files in the future. But Apple and Google said that actually most of the things that were in here, they already know about and have already been able to fix in the past because they've been highlighted by other researchers or their own internal teams. So lots of the things are okay, basically.
I think that was the biggest problem that a lot of people were criticising them for, because standard practice normally is that if you find a vulnerability in something, you tell the company involved. You give them the chance to fix it. And it's not because you're doing them a favour. It's because as soon as you highlight that exploit, it becomes dangerous. As soon as you tell hackers, potential hackers, that there is this flaw, they can start going to execute it. Now, I know this is slightly different because it's the CIA, so it's not exactly like loads of people, but potentially it could be. And I think that's where a lot of people were criticising the way that WikiLeaks handled this particular part.
And there's another side. There's another side to this as well. A lot of the analysis of what's been put out shows that they're old exploits. They were things that might have been a problem in 2014 or 2015, and they've since been patched. And a few security researchers have said, well, this is what we do as our job. We look for these vulnerabilities, we report them. We've already reported them. They've already been fixed. And there was one person that came out and said if he was at the CIA, he'd be kind of embarrassed that if this is the best that they can do, then it's not good enough. There don't appear to be any very major zero-day vulnerabilities in here that are sort of fundamental flaws in software and hardware. And that really, there's a lot of fuss and noise around this story, but it doesn't amount to a great deal. And WikiLeaks saying that, it's going to work with the companies in Silicon Valley to help them get their technology up to spec in terms of security. I'm not sure if the companies in Silicon Valley would want to work with someone that has such close alleged links to the Russian administration. WikiLeaks used to be, it used to have a reputation. Now it still has a reputation, but a very different one.
And also, it seems like a lot of their teams are already on top of this. So it's almost, it's like we don't need to throw us a bone. We're already on, we've fixed these faults. So, like, thanks, but we've got our own teams working on these.
I think there is an element of non-surprise from a lot of people around these sort of disclosures. It's basically hacking or spying agency develops tools to do hacking and spying. Whether they should be disclosing problems that they find and vulnerabilities so they can't be used by other people to Apple and Google, etc., that's another question, and I personally would say that should be their role. But that if they want to exploit these tools, then that's what they're going to develop them for. And there's some interesting stuff in here around how other agencies and how they work together. So quite a few of the vulnerabilities were actually in these CIA documents were developed by GCHQ here in the UK or bought in by the CIA.
Yeah, so there's the link between the security agencies. Is it called the Five Eyes? It's Canada, America, Britain, New Zealand and Australia, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. And so again, it's not really a surprise that these agencies are working in collaboration to develop tools and share what they find out for the benefit of their colleagues in other countries.
No, not really. But there is obviously criticisms around them developing tools to hack people and it's obviously an invasion of personal privacy.
There is that.
I think one of the good things that come out with these sorts of stuff is it really does highlight to people the problems. And people are always saying you have to make sure, not just in terms of this, but you have to make sure your passwords are up to date on certain programs. You need to make sure your software's up to date on certain things. If anything good can come from this, it would be that. It's that, again, it's highlighting to the general public that they need to be more aware of it to protect themselves as much as anything else.
And allegedly there's more to come from WikiLeaks.
Yeah, apparently they say it's the biggest actual trove of information from secret servants agencies that's actually big. They say it's bigger than the Snowden stuff, whether it has in terms of the physical documents, but we'll wait and see on that. Yeah. I guess,
well, that's another problem, isn't it, is that these documents have come out, but we don't know 100% that they're authentic, real. I mean, there are lots of claims in there, and the fact that some of these exploits have been found already suggests that some of them are true.
Yeah.
But it's that problem again, isn't it? It's that where these leaks come from. And it goes back to the way when the documents were leaked about Trump and Russia and all that sort of stuff. It's that, well, how authentic is this?
Yeah, I think Edward Snowden himself took to Twitter in a series of posts and said that based on the level of information, the specificity of the information and his knowledge of how these kind of things operate, it seemed to be legitimate to him. But obviously, there's no real way of knowing, because you'd imagine CIA aren't going to go, yep, that's how we do it. Our third story. Where's Wally, Vicky? Where is he?
I don't know where he is. He's so tiny now. So as with loads of things, inflation has caused things to shrink. So...
Oh, God, that's not why.
Well, no, no. Not technically, not in the same way that we think of inflation, but it is related to something like that.
So what's happened?
So Ben Blatt is a researcher, and in 2013 he did a study that looked at plotting all of the locations of Wally in the seven books by Martin Hanford. And he plotted it, and you could work out 68 locations in these books, and he found out that the author and the illustrator were really sneaky. So it wasn't just a case about making them difficult to find, like in the corners. That he used some proper... He really, really thought about where these characters would go. What he's now done is he's followed this up to just go, hang on, I was looking at a recent Where's Wally book, or Where's Waldo, in the US. It's really hard to find him. Is it because I'm older, or has something changed? So he got a ruler out, and it's not massively scientific, but he got a ruler out, and he measured the pixels that Wally takes up in each of the books from 1987 until, I think it was 2009, and realised that in the first page in the first book contains one Wally for around 225 non-Wally people. But by the last book, the ratio is 1 to 850. And he realised that he's actually shrunk by 80%. Wally has shrunk by 80%.
This is a scandal.
Poor Wally. So Ben Blatt's written a book called Nabokov's Favourite Word is Mauve. And this actually discusses a phenomenon called book inflation. So as things get more popular, the desire to make the books bigger and better, so Harry Potter, for example, Game of Thrones are prime examples of those, Martin Hanford had to make these books harder. He needed to make it, and he couldn't just hide them in different places. So by making Wally smaller, the books necessarily haven't got bigger, but it links into that same phenomenon of this book inflation.
I have a fundamental question about Where's Wally?
Go on.
What is he trying to achieve? Like, what is what is Wally doing? Is he hiding? Are we trying to find him? Or is he just, like, in a busy, busy place?
Is he minding his own business and we're just hunting him down?
Just wants a quiet day in a fairground surrounded by thousands of other people. Yeah.
And why is he never with his dog? Well, that's just careless.
Scattered to the wind. Waldo and Wallamina. Was it Wallamina? There was evil
wizard.
Waldo.
Yeah, there's Waldo that was black and yellow.
Yeah.
Bumblebee Waldo. Yeah. I mean, that's a very good point, Burgess. We're all thinking about where is he and how he shrunk. Actually, we should ask him why he's doing this.
So if you've been trying to find Wally, Waldo, whatever your pronunciation is, and you can't find him, it's not your fault.
That's basically what we're saying. We're a support network for people who are really struggling to find Wally.
It's a curious story, and you can read lots more about it on wired.co.uk. Our final story this week, we welcome a special guest back to the Wired UK podcast, Matt Reynolds. Hello.
Hello.
Good to have you back, formerly of this parish.
It's good to be back. Thank you for, you know, guest appearance.
And you're still in the magazine from time to time.
I am, yeah. So
this is your debut cover feature.
It is, yeah. I'm in the magazine a lot, including my face in that bit at the beginning. So,
so
that's good.
If you want to know what Matt Reynolds looks like, turn to the front of the Wired Smartlist issue and you can see a little picture of him. So you were tasked with putting together the 2017 Wired Smartlist. But what does that mean?
So the Wired Smartlist means we don't pick the best people. Well, put it this way. We asked our network of innovative people.
Stand back a bit, I think.
Oh, okay, sorry.
I've turned up the levels.
I was going to say, I've never been this loud. Yeah. Do you want to just ask that question again? Because, yes. I did a bit of a non sequitur beginning.
That's really loud in my ears. I'm going to turn you down. Just so it's a bit quieter in my ears. Yeah, that's better. And it's still coming through just as loud. Anyway.
Cool.
Yeah, go.
So the Wired Smartlist is something we did in 2013 and 2014, I think, and which is coming back for a bumper edition now, in the magazine now. And what we did is we asked our favourite people, or the best people from the Wired world, the Wired universe. So these are people that are, right at the top of their fields in science, design and art, business, innovation. We basically said to them, we know you're really good. Who's going to be good in the next 5-10 years? Who are we going to be writing about? Who is everyone else going to be hearing about in the next generation?
The idea being that people that are in these industries and really connected are going to know the people that are bubbling under and are really the rising stars. So what kind of people did we go out and ask? Who were our Smartlist judges?
Yeah, so we asked loads of people. So we got Stuart Butterfield, the CEO of Slack. We spoke to Jimmy Wales, director of Wikipedia. We spoke to Melinda Gates, obviously heading up the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Spoke to Frances Morris. She's the director of the Tate Modern. We spoke to Joy Ito, I think that's how you pronounce his name, who's the leader of MIT Media Lab.
Eben Upton from the Raspberry Pi Foundation.
Eben Upton.
Richard Branson. Redzepe, the head chef at Noma. Well, the founder and head chef of Noma. It's a really, really extensive list of some people that we've covered in the magazine in the last year, some people that we've been covering for many years. And as you say, we asked them to pick their rising stars that might be on the front cover of the magazine in 5 years' time. And that's kind of the, not the gag, but it's the gimmick on the front cover of the magazine is there's Stuart Butterfield, the CEO of Slack, holding a copy of Wired Magazine from the year 2020, I think it is.
Yeah, that's right.
With someone else's face on it, and it's the face of the person that he thinks is going to be making major headlines and is already doing amazing work, but that we're all going to know the name of in the next decade. So lots of emails were sent, lots of phone calls were exchanged, lots of research on your part, and we now have the definitive list, which you can read in the current issue of Wired Magazine. But what were some of your favourite picks?
So I think my top pick would be Jimmy Wales' suggestion, and he picked a digital rights activist and lawyer from Pakistan. Her name's Nigat Dad. And what she has done, she set up something called the Digital Rights Foundation. And what that does is about ensuring people generally, but specifically women. She's working on a project, involves women specifically in the minute. It gives them a kind of space online that allows them to kind of freely express themselves, especially for states that have slightly more kind of repressive controls over their people. So it's all about protecting the rights of people to speak openly. And the Digital Rights Foundation is not limited to Pakistan. That's a kind of global initiative. But I think it's really interesting. It's really interesting insight because we're kind of privileged here that we don't have anyone monitoring our internet too badly.
Well, we do.
Well, we do, but they're probably not going to, come knocking on our door if something happens.
It's on a scale.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, it's really important that we've got people that are looking out for, the rights of women and minorities in particular. So I think she's a really amazing person.
And there's a real sort of line of optimism that runs through this. These are the sort of projects and people that are really trying incredibly hard to change the world for the better. And at the moment, they're maybe not getting the kind of publicity and recognition they deserve. And the idea of putting out this list is to say to people, hey, you've heard of Richard Branson, you've heard of Evan Upton, you've heard of René Redzepi. Well, here are some other people that are real heroes in their fields and could do with a little bit more love, shall we say.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, a few themes that came up that we maybe don't hear about so often. So a big theme was, renewable energy. Bertrand Piccard, obviously he did Solar Impulse flight around the world, but he nominated someone whose name I can't remember, but he who I should check.
The pages. Let's see. Yes, Bertrand Piccard nominated Fernando Nilo, the founder and CEO of Recycla Chile.
Exactly. And what they do is make it really, really easy in Chile to recycle old technology. And so that's a massive problem. You know, when you have, you leave your old mobile phones or they go to landfill, they leach quite bad chemicals that can poison water supplies. And so basically what Recycla Chile does is make it really easy for businesses and for consumers to recycle their electronic products. And you know, this is something that we're not very good at doing over here.
Probably with that, it's more common with mobile phones because people know these sort of schemes where you can trade them in for a little bit of cash and recycle your phone or whatever. But for things like old laptops or video games consoles or even remote controls for hi-fis that you've got lying around, anything that you don't really recycle through these online services and apps, which you would do with your mobile phone, obviously they just end up at landfill. And some people will chuck them in the normal waste when you should really be taking them to a local recycling center where they can dispose of them properly. So particularly in countries like Chile, where this kind of infrastructure will be less developed, you'd imagine, than in the UK, this is really important.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, that's a kind of like big theme that came up about, you know, recycling, about renewable energy. Bojan Slat is doing kind of an ocean cleanup project, he was nominated too. He's got this great idea, and he's actually testing it as well, that basically, you know, there's that huge garbage patch in the Pacific Ocean because all those you know, plastic bottles and wrappers and all that stuff that doesn't degrade, it ends up floating on the ocean and clumping together. He's kind of devised a system for bringing that together and trying to basically filter out the ocean. So people that are working on really, really important projects that, I mean, we covered Bojan in the magazine, I don't know, 7-8 months ago.
Yeah.
People don't really hear enough about this stuff. So it's really great chance to hear a bit more about people doing exciting and good things.
Mm-hmm. And was there anything that surprised you? Because you must have spent a good few months putting this together and now you can see it all, the fruits of your labor. Anything that surprised you?
So, you know, CRISPR that we've been hearing about for ages.
Yes.
So there was a couple of nominees involving CRISPR. One, so we spoke to Jennifer Doudna, who headed up the lab that basically she was a co-discoverer of CRISPR, essentially. And she nominated someone that is using, I can't remember her name, but she's the CEO of Caribou Sciences. And she's basically looking at the first commercial applications of CRISPR.
Rachel Horowitz.
That's who it is.
You've got the knowledge, I've got the list of names.
Exactly, yeah. And I didn't want to do the kind of like, you know, guy flips through a magazine on a podcast.
Yep.
But anyway, that's really interesting because I think we've been hearing about CRISPR technology for what? I mean, 3-4 years maybe. But, you know, Rach is really actually starting to look at the applications of it in terms of, you know, how can we use this to modify our crops? How can we use this in insect populations? And actually along that same theme, Cynthia Brazil at MIT Robotics Lab, I think, she nominated Kevin Esfeldt, and he's doing some really interesting stuff in this area. He's all about basically how can we edit the genome of stuff like, say, ticks that carry Lyme disease or mosquitoes that carry malaria or Zika or something. Yeah, how can we edit their genomes so they're no longer able to you know, to carry these diseases.
Yeah.
So obviously the thing is, when you say CRISPR, everyone's like, designer babies and stuff like that. But actually, what this smartness kind of made me realize is that, oh, actually, the people are using this, technology to really kind of cut down on some of the, you know, the most infectious, worst diseases we've got at the minute. So that's really, it was eye-opening for me.
Yeah, so Kevin Esfeldt, in fact, is being profiled in an upcoming issue of the magazine, I think maybe our June issue. And his work is in Martha's Vineyard. So there's this huge population of ticks on rats, I think, that are carrying Lyme disease, and there's a slightly higher infection rate of people around there. So he's wondering if there are ways, as you say, that you can edit the genomes of these creatures so that they are no longer able to carry these diseases, because the fact that they can carry them, while the debate around genetic modification might go on, that isn't a good thing. That isn't something that should be there, and we can design it out. So that's the kind of research he's doing. And as I said, he's profiled in an upcoming issue. So the idea of the Wired Smart List, as well as it's hugely useful for our readers is it's also hugely useful for us. It's a place where we can go and keep track of these phenomenal people who are doing amazing work and make sure that they get the kind of recognition that they deserve and that people hear their stories. So it's a wonderful resource that everyone should definitely check out. It's in the latest issue of Wired magazine, which is out now, and eventually it will be appearing on the Wired website. Matt Reynolds, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
We will leave it there for the week as well for this podcast, and we will see you again next week. Goodbye.
Goodbye.